Sunken Gardens. Marisol's crawler loped across the badlands of the Mare Hadriacum under a tormented Martian sky. At the limits of the troposphere, jet streams twisted, dirty streaks across pale lilac. Marisol watched the winds through the fretted glass of the control bay. Her altered brain suggested one pattern after another. Nests of snakes, nets of dark eels, maps of black arteries. Since morning, the crawler had been descending steadily into the Hellas Basin, and the air pressure was rising. Mars lay like a feverish patient under the thick blanket of air, sweating buried ice. On the horizon, thunderheads rose with explosive speed below the constant scrawl of the jet streams. The basin was strange to Marisol. Her faction, the Patternists, had been assigned to a redemption camp in northern Syrtis Major. There, 200-mile-an-hour surface winds were common, and their pressurized camp had been buried three times by advancing dunes. It had taken her 8 days of constant travel to reach the equator. From overhead, the Regal faction had helped her navigate. Their orbiting city-state, Terraform Cluster, was a nexus of monitor satellites. The Regals showed by their helpfulness that they had her under closer surveillance. The crawler lurched as its six pick-like feet scrabbled down the slopes of a deflation pit. Marisol suddenly saw her own face reflected in the glass, pale and taut, her dark eyes dreamily self-absorbed. It was a bare face, with the anonymous beauty of the genetically reshaped. She rubbed her eyes with nail-bitten fingers. To the west, far overhead, a gout of airborne topsoil surged aside and revealed the ladder, the mighty anchor cable of the Terraform Cluster. Above the winds, the cable faded from sight, vanishing below the metallic glitter of the cluster, swinging aloofly in orbit. Marisol stared at the orbiting city with an uneasy mix of envy, fear, and reverence. She had never been so close to the cluster before, or to the all-important ladder that linked it to the Martian surface. Like most of her faction's younger generation, she had never been into space. The Regals had carefully kept her faction quarantined in the Syrtis Redemption Camp. Life had not come easily to Mars. For 100 years, the Regals of Terraform Cluster had bombarded the Martian surface with giant chunks of ice. This act of planetary engineering was the most ambitious, arrogant, and successful of all the works of man in space. The shattering impacts had torn huge craters in the Martian crust, blasting tons of dust and steam into Mars's threadbare sheet of air. As the temperature rose, buried oceans of Martian permafrost roared forth, leaving networks of twisted badlands and vast expanses of damp mud, smooth and sterile as a television. On these great playas and on the frost-caked walls of channels, cliffs, and calderas, transplanted lichen had clung and leapt into devouring life. In the plains of Eridania and the twisted mega-canyons of Caprates Basin, in the damp and icy regions of the dwindling poles, vast clawing thickets of its sinister growth lay upon the land, massive disaster areas for the inorganic. As the terraforming project had grown, so had the power of Terraform Cluster. As a neutral point in humanity's factional wars, TK was crucial to financiers and bankers of every sect. Even the alien investors, those star-traveling reptiles of enormous wealth, found TK useful and favored it with their patronage. And as TK citizens, the Regals, increased their power, smaller factions faltered and fell under their sway. Mars was dotted with bankrupt factions, financially captured and transported to the Martian surface by the TK plutocrats. Having failed in space, the refugees took Regal charity as ecologists of the Sunken Gardens. Dozens of factions were quarantined in cheerless redemption camps, isolated from one another, their lives pared to a grim frugality. And the visionary Regals made good use of their power. The factions found themselves trapped in the arcane bioaesthetics of post-humanist philosophy, subverted constantly by Regal broadcasts, Regal teaching, Regal culture. With time, even the stubbornest faction would be broken down and digested into the cultural bloodstream of TK. Faction members would be allowed to leave their redemption camp and travel up the ladder. but first they would have to prove themselves. The Patternists had awaited their chance for years. It had come at last in the Ibis Crater competition, an ecological struggle of the factions that would prove the victors' right to regal status. Six factions had sent their champions to the ancient Ibis Crater, each one armed with its group's strongest biotechnologies. It would be a war of the sunken gardens, with the latter as the prize. Mirasol's crawler followed a gully through a chaotic terrain of rocky permafrost that had collapsed in karsts and sinkholes. After 2 hours, the gully ended abruptly. Before Mirasol rose a mountain range of massive slabs and boulders, some with the glassy sheen of impact melt, others scabbed over with lichen. As the crawler started up the slope, the sun came out, and Mirasol saw the crater's outer rim jigsawed in the green of lichen and the glaring white of snow. The oxygen readings were rising steadily. Warm, moist air was drooling from within the crater's lip, leaving a spittle of ice. A 500,000-ton asteroid from the rings of Saturn had fallen here at 15 kilometers a second. But for 2 centuries, rain, creeping glaciers, and lichen had gnawed at the crater's rim, and the wound's raw edges had slumped and scarred. The crawler worked its way up the striated channel of an empty glacier bed. A cold alpine wind keened down the channel, where flourishing patches of lichen clung to exposed veins of ice. Some rocks were striped with sediment from the ancient Martian seas, and the impact had peeled them up and thrown them on their backs. It was winter, the season for pruning the sunken gardens. The treacherous rubble of the crater's rim was cemented with frozen mud. The crawler found the glacier's route and clawed its way up the ice face. The raw slope was striped with winter snow and storm-blown summer dust, stacked in hundreds of red and white layers. With the years, the stripes had warped and rippled in the glacier's flow. Mirasol reached the crest. The crawler ran spider-like along the crater's snowy rim. Below, in a bowl-shaped crater 8 kilometers deep, lay a seething ocean of air. Mirasol stared. Within this gigantic air sump, 20 kilometers across, a broken ring of majestic rain clouds trailed their dark skirts, like duchesses in quadrille, about the ballroom floor of a lens-shaped sea. Thick forests of green and yellow mangroves rimmed the shallow water and had overrun the shattered islands at its center. Pinpoints of brilliant scarlet ibis spattered the trees. A flock of them suddenly spread kite-like wings and took to the air, spreading across the crater in uncounted millions. Mirasol was appalled by the crudity and daring of this ecological concept, its crass and primal vitality. This was what she had come to destroy. The thought filled her with sadness. Then she remembered the years she had spent flattering her regal teachers, collaborating with them in the destruction of her own culture. When the chance at the latter came, she had been chosen. She put her sadness away, remembering her ambitions and her rivals. The history of mankind in space had been a long epic of ambitions and rivalries. From the very first, space colonies had struggled for self-sufficiency and had soon broken their ties with the exhausted Earth. The independent life support systems had given them the mentality of city-states. Strange ideologies had bloomed in the hothouse atmosphere of the O'Neills, and breakaway groups were common. Space was too vast to police. Pioneer elites burst forth, defying anyone to stop their pursuit of aberrant technologies. Quite suddenly, the march of science had become an insane headlong scramble. New sciences and technologies had shattered whole societies in waves of future shock. The shattered cultures coalesced into factions, so thoroughly alienated from one another that they were called humanity only for lack of a better term. The Shapers, for instance, had seized control of their own genetics, abandoning mankind in a burst of artificial evolution. Their rivals, the Mechanists, had replaced flesh with advanced prosthetics. Mirasol's own group, the Patternists, was a breakaway Shaper faction. The Patternists specialized in cerebral asymmetry. With grossly expanded right-brain hemispheres, they were highly intuitive, given to metaphors, parallels, and sudden cognitive leaps. Their inventive minds and quick, unpredictable genius had given them a competitive edge at first. But with these advantages had come grave weaknesses: autism, fugue states, and paranoia. Patternists grew out of control and became grotesque webs of fantasy. With these handicaps, their colony had faltered. Patternist industries went into decline, outpaced by industrial rivals. Competition had grown much fiercer. The Shaper and Mechanist cartels had turned commercial action into a kind of endemic warfare. The Patternist gamble had failed, and the day came when their entire habitat was brought out from around them by regal plutocrats. In a way, it was a kindness. Regals were suave and proud of their ability to assimilate refugees and failures. The Regals themselves had started as dissidents and defectors. Their post-humanist philosophy had given them the moral power and the bland assurance to dominate and absorb factions from the fringes of humanity. And they had the support of the investors, who had vast wealth and the secret techniques of star travel. The crawler's radar alerted Marisol to the presence of a land craft from a rival faction. Leaning forward in her pilot's couch, she put the craft's image on screen. It was a lumpy sphere, balanced uneasily on four long, spindly legs. Silhouetted against the horizon, it moved with a strange, wobbling speed along the opposite lip of the crater, then disappeared down the outward slope. Marisol wondered if it had been cheating. She was tempted to try some cheating herself, to dump a few frozen packets of aerobic bacteria or a few dozen capsules of insect eggs down the slope. But she feared the orbiting monitors of the TK supervisors. Too much was at stake. Not only her own career, but that of her entire faction, huddled bankrupt and despairing in their cold redemption camp. It was said that TK's ruler, the post-human being they called the Lobster King, would himself watch the contest. To fail before his black, abstracted gaze would be a horror. On the crater's outside slope below her, a second rival craft appeared, lurching and slithering with insane, aggressive grace. The craft's long, supple body moved with a sidewinder's looping and coiling, holding aloft a massive, shining head, like a faceted mirror ball. Both rivals were converging on the rendezvous camp, where the six contestants would receive their final briefing from the regal advisor. Marisol hurried forward. When the camp first flashed into sight on her screen, Marisol was shocked. The place was huge and absurdly elaborate, a drug dream of paneled geodesies and colored minarets, spiraling in the lichenous desert like an abandoned chandelier. This was a camp for regals. Here the arbiters and sophists of the bio-arts would stay and judge the crater as the newly planted ecosystems struggled among themselves for supremacy. The camp's airlocks were surrounded with shining green thickets of lichen, where the growth feasted on escaped humidity. Marisol drove her crawler through the yawning airlock and into a garage. Inside the garage, robot mechanics were scrubbing and polishing the coiled 100-meter length of the snake craft and the gleaming black abdomen of an 8-legged crawler. The black crawler was crouched with its periscoped head sunk downward, as if ready to pounce. Its swollen belly was marked with a red hourglass and the corporate logos of its faction. The garage smelled of dust and grease overlaid with floral perfumes. Marisol left the mechanics to their work and walked stiffly down a long corridor, stretching the kinks out of her back and shoulders. A latticework door sprang apart into filaments and resealed itself behind her. She was in a dining room that clinked and rattled with the high-pitched repetitive sound of regal music. Its walls were paneled with tall display screens showing startlingly beautiful garden panoramas. A pulpy-looking servo, whose organo-metallic casing and squat, smiling head had a swollen, almost diseased appearance, showed her to a chair. Marisol sat, denting the heavy white tablecloth with her knees. There were seven places at the table. The regal advisor's tall chair was at the table's head. Marisol's assigned position gave her a sharp idea of her own status. She sat at the far end of the table, on the advisor's left. Two of her rivals had already taken their places. One was a tall, red-haired shaper with long, thin arms, whose sharp face and bright, worried eyes gave him a querulous, bird-like look. The other was a sullen, feral mechanist with prosthetic hands and a paramilitary tunic marked at the shoulders with a red hourglass. Marisol studied her two rivals with silent, sidelong glances. Like her, they were both young. The Regals favored the young, and they encouraged captive factions to expand their populations widely. This strategy cleverly subverted the old guard of each faction in a tidal wave of their own children, indoctrinated from birth by Regals. The bird-like man, obviously uncomfortable with his place directly at the advisor's right, looked as if he wanted to speak, but dared not. The piratical mech sat staring at his artificial hands, his ears stoppered with headphones. Each place setting had a squeeze bulb of liqueur. Regals, who were used to weightlessness in orbit, used these bulbs by habit, and their presence here was both a privilege and a humiliation. The door fluttered open again, and two more rivals burst in, almost as if they had raced. The first was a flabby mech, still not used to gravity, whose sagging limbs were supported by an extraskeletal framework. The second was a severely mutated shaper whose elbowed legs terminated in grasping hands. The pedal hands were gemmed with heavy rings that clicked against each other as she waddled across the parquet floor. The woman with the strange legs took her place across from the bird-like man. They began to converse haltingly in a language that none of the others could follow. The man in the framework, gasping audibly, lay in obvious pain in the chair across from Marisol. His plastic eyeballs looked as blank as chips of glass. His sufferings in the pull of gravity showed that he was new to Mars, and his place in the competition meant that his faction was powerful. Marisol despised him. Marisol felt a nightmarish sense of entrapment. Everything about her competitors seemed to proclaim their sickly unfitness for survival. They had a haunted, hungry look, like starving men in a lifeboat who wait with secret eagerness for the first to die. She caught a glimpse of herself reflected in the bowl of a spoon, and saw with a flash of insight how she must appear to the others. Her intuitive right brain was swollen beyond human bounds, distorting her skull. Her face had the blank prettiness of her genetic heritage, but she could feel the bleak strain of her expression. Her body looked shapeless under her quilted pilot's vest and dun-drab general-issue blouse and trousers. Her fingertips were raw from biting. She saw in herself the fade, defeated aura of her faction's older generation, those who had tried and failed in the great world of space, and she hated herself for it. They were still waiting for the sixth competitor when the plonking music reached a sudden crescendo and the Regal advisor arrived. Her name was Arcadia Sorienti, Incorporated. She was a member of TK's ruling oligarchy, and she swayed through the bursting door with the careful steps of a woman not used to gravity. She wore the investor-style clothing of a high-ranking diplomat. The Regals were proud of their diplomatic ties with the alien investors, since investor patronage proved their own vast wealth. The Sorienti's knee-high boots had false bird-like toes, scaled with investor hide. She wore a heavy skirt of gold cords braided with jewels, and a stiff, wrist-length formal jacket with embroidered cuffs. A heavy collar formed an arcing, multicolored frill behind her head. Her blonde hair was set in an interlaced style as complex as computer wiring. The skin of her bare legs had a shiny, glossy look, as if freshly enameled. Her eyelids gleamed with soft reptilian pastels. One of her corporate ladyship's two body servos helped her to her seat. The Sorienti leaned forward brightly, interlacing small, pretty hands so crusted with rings and bracelets that they resembled gleaming gauntlets. "I hope the five of you have enjoyed this chance for an informal talk," she said sweetly, just as if such a thing were possible. "I'm sorry I was delayed. Our sixth participant will not be joining us." There was no explanation. The Regals never publicized any action of theirs that might be construed as a punishment. The looks of the competitors, alternately stricken and calculating, showed that they were imagining the worst. The two squat servos circulated around the table, dishing out courses of food from trays balanced on their flabby heads. The competitors picked uneasily at their plates. The display screen behind the advisor flicked into a schematic diagram of the Ibis crater. "Please notice the revised boundary lines. the Sorienti said. I hope that each of you will avoid trespassing, not merely physically but biologically as well. She looked at them seriously. Some of you may plan to use herbicides. This is permissible, but the spreading of spray beyond your sector's boundaries is considered crass. Bacteriological establishment is a subtle art. The spreading of tailored disease organisms is an aesthetic distortion. Please remember that your activities here are a disruption of what should ideally be natural process. Therefore, the period of biotic seeding will last only 12 hours. Thereafter, the new complexity level will be allowed to stabilize itself without any other interference at all. Avoid self-aggrandizement and confine yourselves to a primal role as catalysts. The Sorienti's speech was formal and ceremonial. Mirasol studied the display screen, noting with much satisfaction that her territory had been expanded. Seen from overhead, the crater's roundness was deeply marred. Mirasol's sector, the southern one, showed the long, flattened scar of a major landslide, where the crater wall had slumped and flowed into the pit. The simple ecosystem had recovered quickly, and mangroves festooned the rubble's lowest slopes. Its upper slopes were gnawed by lichen and glaciers. The sixth sector had been erased, and Mirasol's share was almost 20 square kilometers of new land. It would give her faction's ecosystem more room to take root before the deadly struggle began in earnest. This was not the first such competition. The Regals had held them for decades as an objective test of the skills of rival factions. It helped the Regals' divide-and-conquer policy, to set the factions against one another. And in the centuries to come, as Mars grew more hospitable to life, the gardens would surge from their craters and spread across the surface. Mars would become a warring jungle of separate creations. For the Regals, the competitions were closely studied simulations of the future, and the competitions gave the factions motives for their work. With the garden wars to spur them, the ecological sciences had advanced enormously. Already, with the progress of science and taste, many of the oldest craters had become eco-aesthetic embarrassments. The Ibis crater had been an early, crude experiment. The faction that had created it was long gone, and its primitive creation was now considered tasteless. Each gardening faction camped beside its own crater, struggling to bring it to life. But the competitions were a shortcut up the ladder. The competitors' philosophies and talents made into flesh would carry out a proxy struggle for supremacy. The sine wave curves of growth, the rallies and declines of expansion and extinction, would scroll across the monitors of the Regal judges like stock market reports. This complex struggle would be weighed in each of its aspects: technological, philosophical, biological, and aesthetic. The winners would abandon their camps to take on Regal wealth and power. They would roam TK's jeweled corridors and revel in its perquisites: extended lifespans, corporate titles, cosmopolitan tolerance, and the interstellar patronage of the investors. When red dawn broke over the landscape, the five were poised around the Ibis crater, awaiting the signal. The day was calm, with only a distant nexus of jet streams marring the sky. Mirasol watched pink-stained sunlight creep down the inside slope of the crater's western wall. In the mangrove thickets, birds were beginning to stir. Mirasol waited tensely. She had taken a position on the upper slopes of the landslide's raw debris. Radar showed her rivals spaced along the interior slopes. To her left, the hourglass crawler and the jewel-headed snake. To her right, a mantis-like crawler and the globe on stilts. The signal came, sudden as lightning. A meteor of ice shot from orbit and left a shockwave cloud plume of ablated steam. Mirasol charged forward. The patternist's strategy was to concentrate on the upper slopes and the landslide's rubble, a marginal niche where they hoped to excel. Their cold crater in Syrtis Major had given them some expertise in alpine species, and they hoped to exploit this strength. The landslide's long slope, far above sea level, was to be their power base. The crawler lurched down slope, blasting out a fine spray of lichenophagous bacteria. Suddenly, the air was full of birds. Across the crater, the globe on stilts had rushed down to the waterline and was laying waste the mangroves. Fine wisps of smoke showed the slicing beam of a heavy laser. Burst after burst of birds took wing, peeling from their nests to wheel and dip in terror. At first their frenzied cries came as a high-pitched whisper. Then, as the fear spread, the screeching echoed and re-echoed, building to a mindless surf of pain. In the crater's dawn-warmed air, the scarlet motes hung in their millions, swirling and coalescing like drops of blood in freefall. Mirasol scattered the seeds of alpine rock crops. The crawler picked its way down the talus, spraying fertilizer into cracks and crevices. She pried up boulders and released a scattering of invertebrates. Nematodes, mites, sow bugs, altered millipedes. She splattered the rocks with gelatin to feed them until the mosses and ferns took hold. The cries of the birds were appalling. Downslope, the other factions were thrashing in the muck at sea level, wreaking havoc, destroying the mangroves so that their own creations could take hold. The great snake looped and ducked through the canopy, knotting itself, ripping up swaths of mangroves by the roots. As Mirasol watched, the top of its faceted head burst open and released a cloud of bats. The mantis crawler was methodically marching along the borders of its sector, its saw-edged arms reducing everything before it into kindling. The hourglass crawler had slashed through its territory, leaving a muddy network of fire zones. Behind it rose a wall of smoke. It was a daring ploy. Sterilizing the sector by fire might give the new biome a slight advantage. Even a small boost could be crucial as exponential rates of growth took hold. But the Ibis crater was a closed system. The use of fire required great care. There was only so much air within the bowl. Mirasol worked grimly. Insects were next. They were often neglected in favor of massive sea beasts or flashy predators. But in terms of biomass, gram by gram, insects could overwhelm. She blasted a carton downslope to the shore, where it melted, releasing aquatic termites. She shoved aside flat shelves of rock, planting egg cases below their sun-warmed surfaces. She released a cloud of leaf-eating midges, their tiny bodies packed with bacteria. Within the crawler's belly, rack after automatic rack was thawed and fired through nozzles, dropped through spiracles or planted in the holes jabbed by pick-like feet. Each faction was releasing a potential world. Near the water's edge, the mantis had released a pair of things like giant black sailplanes. They were swooping through the clouds of Ibis, opening great sieved mouths. On the islands in the center of the crater's lake, scaled walruses clambered on the rocks, blowing steam. The stilt ball was laying out an orchard in the mangrove's wreckage. The snake had taken to the water, its faceted head leaving a wake of V-waves. In the hourglass sector, smoke continued to rise. The fires were spreading, and the spider ran frantically along its network of zones. Mirasol watched the movement of the smoke as she released a horde of marmots and rock squirrels. A mistake had been made. As the smoky air gushed upward in the feeble Martian gravity, a fierce valley wind of cold air from the heights flowed downward to fill the vacuum. The mangroves burned fiercely. Shattered networks of flaming branches were flying into the air. The spider charged into the flames, smashing and trampling. Mirasol laughed, imagining demerits piling up in the judge's databanks. Her talus slopes were safe from fire. There was nothing to burn. The ibis flock had formed a great wheeling ring above the shore. Within their scattered ranks flitted the dark shapes of airborne predators. The long plume of steam from the meteor had begun to twist and break. A sullen wind was building up. Fire had broken out in the snake's sector. The snake was swimming in the sea's muddy waters, surrounded by bales of bright green kelp. Before its pilot noticed, fire was already roaring through a great piled heap of the wreckage it had left on shore. There were no windbreaks left. Air poured down the denuded slope. The smoke column guttered and twisted, its black clouds alive with sparks. A flock of ibis plunged into the cloud. Only a handful emerged. Some of them were flaming visibly. Mirasol began to know fear. As smoke rose to the crater's rim, it cooled and started to fall outward and downward. A vertical whirlwind was forming, a torus of hot smoke and cold wind. The crawler scattered sea-packed hay for pygmy mountain goats. Just before her, an ibis fell from the sky with a dark, squirming shape, all claws and teeth clinging to its neck. She rushed forward and crushed the predator. then stopped and stared distractedly across the crater. Fires were spreading with unnatural speed. Small puffs of smoke rose from a dozen places, striking large heaps of wood with uncanny precision. Her altered brain searched for a pattern. The fires springing up in the mantis sector were well beyond the reach of any falling debris. In the spider zone, flames had leapt the fire breaks without leaving a mark. The pattern felt wrong to her, eerily wrong, as if the destruction had a force all its own, a raging synergy that fed upon itself. The pattern spread into a devouring crescent. Mirasol felt the dread of lost control, the sweating fear an orbiter feels at the hiss of escaping air, or the way a suicide feels at the first bright gush of blood. Within an hour, the garden sprawled beneath a hurricane of hot decay. The dense columns of smoke had flattened like thunderheads at the limits of the garden's sunken troposphere. Slowly, a spark-shot gray haze, dripping ash like rain, began to ring the crater. Screaming birds circled beneath the foul torus, falling by tens and scores and hundreds. Their bodies littered the garden sea, their bright plumage blurred with ash in a steel-gray sump. The land craft of the others continued to fight the flames, smashing unharmed through the fire's charred borderlands. Their efforts were useless, a pathetic ritual before the disaster. Even the fire's malicious purity had grown tired and tainted. The oxygen was falling. The flames were dimmer and spread more slowly, releasing a dark nastiness of half-combusted smoke. Where it spread, nothing that breathed could live. Even the flames were killed as the smoke billowed along the crater's crushed and smoldering slopes. Mirasol watched a group of striped gazelles struggling up the barren slopes of the talus in search of air. Their dark eyes, fresh from the laboratory, rolled in timeless animal fear. Their coats were scorched, their flanks heaved, their mouths dripped foam. One by one, they collapsed in convulsions, kicking at the lifeless Martian rock as they slid and fell. It was a vile sight, the image of a blighted spring. An oblique flash of red downslope to her left attracted her attention. A large red animal was skulking among the rocks. She turned the crawler and picked her way toward it, wincing as a dark surf of poisoned smoke broke across the fretted glass. She spotted the animal as it broke from cover. It was a scorched and gasping creature, like a great red ape. She dashed forward and seized it in its crawler's arms. Held aloft, it clawed and kicked, hammering the crawler's arms with a smoldering branch. In revulsion and pity, she crushed it. Its bodice of tight-sewn ibis feathers tore, revealing blood-slicked human flesh. Using the crawler's grips, she tugged at a heavy tuft of feathers on its head. The tight-fitting mask ripped free, and the dead man's head slumped forward. She rolled it back, revealing a face tattooed with stars. The ornithopter sculled above the burned-out garden, its long red wings beating with dreamlike fluidity. Mirasol watched the Sorrenti's painted face as her corporate ladyship stared into the shining viewscreen. The ornithopter's powerful cameras cast image after image onto the tabletop screen, lighting the regal's face. The tabletop was littered with the Sorrenti's elegant knick-knacks. An inhaler case, a half-empty jeweled squeeze bulb, lorgnette binoculars, a stack of cassette tapes. "An unprecedented case," her ladyship murmured. "It was not a total dieback, after all, but merely the extinction of everything with lungs. There must be strong survivorship among the lower orders, fish, insects, annelids. Now that the rains settled the ash, you can see the vegetation making a strong comeback. Your own section seems almost undamaged." "Yes," Mirasol said. "The natives were unable to reach it with torches before the firestorm had smothered itself." The Sorrenti leaned back into the tasseled arms of her couch. "I wish you wouldn't mention them so loudly, even between ourselves. No one would believe me." "The others never saw them," the Regal said. "They were too busy fighting the flames." She hesitated briefly. "You were wise to confide in me first." Mirasol locked eyes with her new patroness, then looked away. "There was no one else to tell. They'd have said I built a pattern out of nothing but my own fears." "You have your faction to think of," the Sorienti said with an air of sympathy. With such a bright future ahead of them, they don't need a renewed reputation for paranoid fantasies. She studied the screen. The Patternists are the winners by default. It certainly makes an interesting case study. If the new garden grows tiresome, we can have the whole crater sterilized from orbit. Some other faction can start again with a clean slate. Don't let them build too close to the edge, Mirasol said. Her corporate ladyship watched her attentively, tilting her head. I have no proof, Mirasol said, but I can see the pattern behind it all. The natives had to come from somewhere. The colony that stocked the crater must have been destroyed in that huge landslide. Was that your work? Did your people kill them? The Sorienti smiled. You're very bright, my dear. You will do well up the ladder, and you can keep secrets. Your office as my secretary suits you very well. They were destroyed from orbit, Mirasol said. Why else would they hide from us? You tried to annihilate them. It was a long time ago, the Regal said. In the early days, when things were shakier. They were researching the secret of starflight, techniques only the investors know. Rumor says they reached success at last in their redemption camp. After that, there was no choice. Then they were killed for the investors' profit, Mirasol said. She stood up quickly and walked around the cabin, her new jeweled skirt clattering around the knees. So that the aliens could go on toying with us, hiding their secret, selling us trinkets. The Regal folded her hands with a clicking of rings and bracelets. Our Lobster King is wise, she said. If humanity's efforts turned to the stars, what would become of terraforming? Why should we trade the power of creation itself to become like the investors? But think of the people, Mirasol said. Think of them losing their technologies, degenerating into human beings, a handful of savages eating bird meat. Think of the fear they felt for generations, the way they burned their own home and killed themselves when they saw us coming to smash and destroy their world. Aren't you filled with horror? For humans, the Sorienti said. No. But can't you see? You've given this planet life as an art form, as an enormous game. You force us to play in it, and those people were killed for it. Can't you see how that blights everything? Our game is reality, the Regal said. She gestured at the viewscreen. You can't deny the savage beauty of destruction. You defend this catastrophe. The Regal shrugged. If life worked perfectly, how could things evolve? Aren't we post-human? Things grow, things die. In time, the cosmos kills us all. The cosmos has no meaning, and its emptiness is absolute. That's pure terror, but it's also pure freedom. Only our ambitions and our creations can fill it. And that justifies your actions? We act for life, the Regal said. Our ambitions have become this world's natural laws. We blunder because life blunders. We go on because life must go on. When you've taken the long view, from orbit, when the power we wield is in your own hands, then you can judge us. She smiled. You will be judging yourself. You'll be Regal. But what about your captive factions, your agents, who do your will? Once we had our own ambitions. We failed, and now you isolate us, indoctrinate us, make us into rumors. We must have something of our own. Now we have nothing. That's not so. You have what we've given you. You have the ladder. The vision stung Mirasol. Power, light, the hint of justice. This world with its sins and sadness shrunk to a bright arena far below. Yes, she said at last. Yes, we do.